From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. John Warnock, the co-founder of the software company Adobe, says the revolution of personal computers was all about graphics. And most of those graphics, he says, were invented in Utah. There was something about the fledgling computer sciences department at the University of Utah in the 60s and 70s that inspired big thinking. Evans and Sutherland, WordPerfect, Netscape, Pixar, Atari, Adobe, they were all companies that had their creative beginnings at Utah. Today in the program, we're continuing our series of conversations about the future of higher education by talking about how universities create, or anyway, inspire a new generation of innovators. Warnock is our guest throughout the hour today. We'll talk about where his ideas came from and how they were cultivated in an atmosphere where he felt free to discover. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So we've just started this series of programs about the future of higher education, but there is a theme that seems to be developing, and that is the importance of embracing technology. So today in the program, we're asking, how do universities stimulate and encourage a new generation of innovators? Dr. John Warnock is our guest today. He was a student at the University of Utah in the 60s, which was a remarkable time of creativity in the computer sciences. Warnock, of course, founded Adobe Systems, one of the most successful software companies in the world. And he's joining us today. We're asking how you create in an atmosphere of discovery. How do you create that atmosphere itself? What he thinks about the role of technology in higher education and other things. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Dr. John Warnock co-founded the Adobe Systems company that I mentioned along with Charles Geschke. He retired from the company's as the company's CEO in 2001, but he and Geschke remain co-chairs of the board. Together, they've received numerous awards, including the National Medal of Technology and Innovation, the Marconi Award, and the 2008 Entrepreneurs of the Year Award. Dr. Warnock is in Salt Lake City to present the keynote address in the Siciliano Forum. We'll give you the details about that. It happens today at the Marriott Library. In fact, just after the program, 12:30, we'll give you the details as we go. And Dr. Warnock, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
So nice to be here.
So as I understand, you were born here.
Yes.
Which I suppose naturally sort of leads to a question, at least it did for me, about what this place, and not just your education, but what Utah had to do with the ideas that were going on in your brain, if it had anything at all. I suppose it did.
I was very fortunate in high school in that I had a high school teacher that completely turned me around and got me interested in mathematics. Came to the university and proceeded to get a bachelor's in philosophy and mathematics and then a master's in mathematics. And then computers came into my life. And I was working in the Marriott Engineering Building in the computer center. And a remarkable thing, Utah at that time had almost no computer science department.
Yeah.
And James Fletcher was the president of the university at that time. And he recruited David C. Evans from Berkeley, right, to head a new computer science department. And Dave Evans had a contract at Berkeley to do time-sharing research on a project called Project Genie with the Advanced Research Projects Agency. When he came to Utah, he got another ARPA project grant for trying to look into interactive man-machine interactivity. And so that was sort of the name of his project. And he recruited some of the best brains in the country to come to Utah.
Yeah.
I sort of accidentally got associated with that group and switched my major from mathematics to engineering. And in the next 3 or 4 years, the world changed. There was an enormously creative group of people. And the history that followed that, a lot of the innovations that are involved in the personal computer industry came from Dave Evans graduates.
Yeah. I want to actually break that down because I think getting at what it was about Evans that seems to help people think clearly about their projects and think creatively, I think, is an important thing. But I want to back up a little bit, because you said you just sort of passed by the idea of mathematics and philosophy. And I wanted to say, what was it about philosophy that interested you?
Well, at some level, mathematics and philosophy are highly related fields if you go back into the history of science.
Of course.
And I gravitated towards both subjects, and the philosophy aspect gives you the softer side, sort of the intellectual framework and how the brain works and how people think and how the world works. And mathematics sort of gives you an infrastructure of how to sort of rigorously think about that.
Yeah.
So that
tells me you were interested in both parts.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I always have been. And I, in college, I obviously took all the requirements, but I also, I believe, had a very diverse education. A lot of the humanities, a lot of liberal arts, and not just engineering and mathematics.
See, we're going to come back around to that question, because I think when you're talking about – this is one of the things that comes up all the time when you're talking about the future of higher education, and that – and especially online learning and how technology plays out, and whether or not you should just focus majors. You don't have to worry about the philosophy part. You don't have to worry about the humanities part, that people should structure their majors in a more sort of focused way. So I'll come back to that.
Okay.
But I once heard you answer the question, what would you have done if you hadn't gone into computer sciences? And you said maybe the arts, and maybe photography, you said. And I was trying to see the connection between those two.
I'm a right-sided, left-sided brain person. And I'm interested in the visual aspects of the way you think and the way you put things together. And so I've never thought of the world as being divided particularly between the visual and the analytic side.
See, I think that explains a lot about you, because I think a lot of us do segregate those worlds. And because graphics was so important to the sort of central insight of what you became and what you created – the fact that you were able to put those two together may say something important about you.
I imagine, but you know, building large organizations takes a whole diversity of people, and not one person does that.
No, of course. You mentioned the sort of it was really brand new, I guess, in some ways, when you first came to the computer sciences department. I think you said at one point, you came in 1965 to the computer sciences department at the University of Utah.
Well, 66.
66. Yeah. So there were like two people?
Yeah. and the computer – in those days, there really weren't any computer science textbooks.
Right.
And so if you were a professor in computer science, you sort of had to rely on what you knew and not what you got from curricula from – other people in the business. So it was really getting invented at that time, and everything was new.
Yeah.
How you thought about things. Dave brought people who were sort of at the cutting edge, but there was a whole community of people across the United States in the ARPA community that were studying all aspects of computer science. And it was actually the collaboration between all those universities that really gave us the environment that we have today.
This idea of collaboration is really crucial.
Yes, it is.
You know, if you think about the names, I mean, you think about you, yourself, Dr. John Warnock. You think about Nolan Bushnell and Alan Kay and Jim Blinn and James Clark and Ed Catmull and Alan Ashton. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary the people who came out and the way they were thinking. So what was it about Dave Evans, do you think? I mean, because you've said that he didn't tell people why they couldn't do things. He explained how they could do things, I think is how you put it.
But he was not the boss, okay?
Right.
He was there, and his extraordinary talent was just to give you self-confidence that you could do stuff. that you could do new stuff. And when you did do new stuff, he was incredibly supportive. I think a lot of principal investigators sort of say, well, gee, here's what I want to do.
Yeah.
Okay, and direct their students to do what they want to do. And Dave was not like that at all. He was just incredibly supportive. And when somebody had an idea, he was just incredibly supportive of pursuing the idea and sort of bringing the whole thing together. So there was no evidence of a superego there.
Yeah. So he would just, within reason, let you kind of go on your way and discover.
Yes. And all of the ARPA contracts in those days were that way. There was no specific task agenda that the government wanted. What they wanted was every couple of months, I think it was actually every quarter, they wanted a page and a half report of what you've been doing.
Yeah.
And they let the principal investigators, because they were the best scientists in the country, do what they wanted to do. And it's not – that doesn't exist today.
I want to – ask you about that, because the role of government, I think, is interesting in terms of cultivating new innovation. You mentioned ARPA. Let me just explain. It's
Advanced Projects Research Agency.
Yeah, Advanced Research Projects Agency. Yes, that's right, ARPA.
Yeah.
Founded – this has been more than 50 years ago, created as a response to the Soviet space program.
That's right. It was founded by Eisenhower, actually. But when Kennedy took over, Bob McNamara continued it. But there are PBS programs on ARPA, but they never mention the Information Projects Technology Office.
Yeah. It's another
They all talk about ARPA in the defense business and in the space business, but they ignore actually what I think is probably the most important part of ARPA, and that was the IPTO.
Yeah.
IPTO.
And this brings in Ivan Sutherland.
Yes.
He was head
of IPTO. The thing that was interesting about that is that all of the projects at the universities, like the ones Dave had, were not classified. There was no spook work going on. There was no defense work going on. This was all sort of research into computer and information processing. So there was artificial intelligence research being done at Stanford under John McCarthy and also being done by Marvin Minsky at MIT. Mm. There was supercomputer research at Illinois. There was network research at Volt, Brannick, and Newman. There was mini computer research at St. Louis University. Rand Corporation had their piece of the communication part. UCLA had its part. Utah had the graphics part. And all of these researchers would get together, and they were the who's who of early computer science, and they would meet and say, gee, what are we doing?
Yeah.
You know? And the result of that was amazing. Essentially, the computer industry as we know it today was mostly invented by the students under those projects.
But the government was playing a role.
The government played a huge role.
So what is the difference, do you think, today? I get a sense you don't think the same thing could happen today.
Well, the major competitor was the National Science Foundation.
Yeah.
And the National Science Foundation essentially gives grants to projects and professors. And they're typically quite small. And what ARPA wanted to do was build centers of excellence. In other words, they wanted to put a chunk of money in to build substantial efforts in particular areas of research around computing. And that's what they did. Now, the money today seems like it was trivial, but I think Dave Evans' grant was like $5 million a year or something. Mm. But that was a lot of money in those days. And he used that to buy equipment and staff and build the infrastructure where he could do the research. And that kind of grant structure just sort of doesn't exist, where it's sort of let's trust the researchers and not tell them what to do.
Hmm. Do you also wonder if there's a a pretty strong suspicion of government these days among some. And I wonder if there's some sense that, you know, that the private sector should be the ones taking care of this. The government doesn't really have a role in that sense.
Well, there's a whole story about that too. The private sector takes care of a lot of it, but the private sector is motivated. I mean, if you're a public company, you're motivated by quarterly revenues. And that's just the way the system works.
Yeah.
And corporations have a tendency to finance the things that are going to bolster revenue. They're not particularly interested in basic research anymore. They used to be. IBM had a huge research labs. Bell Labs had a huge research labs. Xerox had a huge research lab. But it's the way Wall Street works and the way it's very hard to sort of fund fundamental things that look 10 years out.
Mm.
And the government, in the case of ARPA, it was enormously efficient. You would think it would be full of bureaucracy. But as I mentioned, all they wanted was a page and a half report. And they trusted the researchers. And you just don't see that much.
I wanted to ask you what was the central problem that got you thinking? Do you think if there was one? I'm not sure you'll be able to distill it to one thing that got you. I mean, but the thing that became Adobe was – can you boil it down to a central issue you were trying to solve or trying to think about?
Yes. We at Park in the 70s
– this is Xerox Park.
Xerox Park. Well, the interesting thing that happened was the last – director of IPTO was a fellow named Bob Taylor.
Yeah.
And Bob Taylor got approached by Xerox and George Paik in particular, and he said, we want to build a research laboratory on the West Coast. Will you join to be one of the heads of the computer science part of that? And since Bob Taylor knew every single graphics or every single ARPA graduate from all the universities because he was head of IPTO, he recruited them all.
Hmm.
He recruited the best talent from around the country to come to Xerox. And the charter of Xerox at that time was to invent the future of the office.
Yeah.
In 1974, they built the first personal computer with a graphic user interface, with a mouse, with a keyboard. And the thing is, most people, when they read about the history of the personal computer, think of 1978 or 1979 and Apple.
Yep.
They don't see the Xerox Park part of it because Xerox never was able to commercialize that product.
So, and they were really secretive, you also said.
They were incredibly secretive.
But there's a great story you tell about I don't remember who it was. I'm not sure if you did. When I heard you tell this story, somebody at Xerox said, it'll be okay if we let this Steve Jobs guy come and take a look at what we're doing.
Some people said that. Here's the story. If you read the Steve Jobs book, the story was that Steve said he would sell some stock in Apple, allow Xerox to invest in Apple if he could be allowed to visit Park.
Yeah.
And so he was negotiating with the corporate executives in Rochester, and they said yes. And a lot of the researchers at Xerox said, this is crazy. You can't let him in the door. So Steve visited Park in 1979. And I was working at Park at that.
Well, what was the condition of Apple at the time? I mean, he had none of these ideas.
No, he had none of those ideas. He had the Apple II, and it was the normal light green phosphor on a dark green background kind of display, much like the IBM PC. And, you know, so he came into Park, and I think these were – he was blown away. He was just blown away of what he saw. He saw machines being networked. He saw laser printers. He saw file servers. He saw the environment that we have today.
Yeah.
Okay.
He saw a mouse.
He saw the pointy device. He did. So he went away. And then he said, well, you haven't opened the kimono enough. I've got to come back. So he made about three trips back to Park and was asking questions and just said, well, how does this work and how does this work? So he came back and he was blown away. And privately, he was saying to his people, this is the way the world has to work. And so he went away and he hired Larry Tesler and he hired Bruce Horn and he started the LISA project. Well, then Apple sort of got involved and took jobs off the LISA project and they've said, well, let him play with this little thing that they're building called the Macintosh.
Right.
And when Chuck and I started Adobe, we were interested in automating the world of publishing.
Yeah.
We really were interested. We figured that we could do this, that we could build better tools than anybody had seen before. And in particular, we had a particularly good handle on printing.
Yeah.
And printing is such a big component of any office environment and such a big component of the world of communications at that time that and it was funny. 3 months after Adobe got into business, I got a phone call from, hi, this is Steve Jobs. He said, my guys, Bob Belleville, who came out of Xerox, said, you guys are doing really interesting stuff. They were in a position where they were about to announce the Macintosh, but the printing that they had off of the Macintosh was called the Image Writer. And if you had 72 dots on the screen, it could print each of the dots, but no one would send a letter that was created on a Macintosh because the quality of print just wasn't there.
Yeah.
And people are used to seeing high-quality print. So we showed him PostScript, which was our answer to the world of printing.
Yeah.
And he almost instantly decided he wanted to buy the company. We turned him down, but entered into about a year development project where – year and a half development project where we would help design the hardware and all the software to build the LaserWriter. And it's my personal sort of egocentric opinion that if the Macintosh didn't have the LaserWriter, the Macintosh would have failed because you couldn't put it into an office environment. I became close friends with Steve and Adobe became close friends with Steve. And when Steve was fired in 85, he went off to form Next and we immediately formed a partnership to provide the operating system for Next, help provide all of the graphics machinery. It was called Display PostScript at that time. And then Apple, when Steve came back, bought Next, and the operating system sort of came back with it.
Dr. John Warnock is with us, the co-founder of the software company Adobe Systems. He's in Salt Lake City to give the keynote address at the 16th Annual Siciliano Forum. It happens today at 12:30 at the Marriott Library at the University of Utah campus. You can visit our website for more details, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our series of conversations about the future of higher education. Today, we're talking about how universities create or inspire a new generation of innovators. Our guest is Dr. John Warnock. He's the co-founder of the software company Adobe Systems. He's in Salt Lake City to give the keynote address of the 16th Annual Siciliano Forum, our series of conversations. It's a partnership with the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We'll give you the details, by the way, about that as we go along. So I wanted to shift gears a bit. And one of the things that you've talked a great deal about lately anyway is how traditional organizations or institutions, like media organizations in particular, are going to have to embrace technology to survive. And I wondered, because you've said that they cannot hold on to the past. And the question is, what do you think is holding institutions like, newspapers, those kinds of things? What's holding them back, do you think, if there is something?
Well, it's really interesting. I was very fortunate to be on the board of directors of Knight Ridder Newspapers. in sort of the mid-90s, about 2003, I think, to about 2006. And they had 22 newspapers. And they invited me on the board because they wanted a technological component on their board of directors. And they had a couple of guys, but I was more related to the publishing industry than the others. And I remember the first board meeting. I said, look, guys, you're either in the information business or you're in the newspaper business. And if you think that you're in the newspaper business, you're done. Because you have to switch gears and you have to say, how in the modern world can I disseminate information under a different model?
Yeah.
Now, if you think about what gives newspapers and what has always given newspapers a competitive advantage and why they could attract advertising and why they could make the kind of money that they used to make is because they had huge amounts of capital infrastructure. They had big printing presses. In some cases, like Knight Ridder, they had pulp plants that produced the paper itself. So they were horizontally integrated.
Yeah.
They had good communication, but they also had distribution networks. They had ways of printing the paper and getting it out to millions of people on a daily basis. And if you think about entering that business, it costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
Now, here comes the internet, and information is frictionless.
Yep. You don't need pulp anymore.
You don't need pulp anymore. You don't need distribution. You don't need any of those things. And the whole cost structure has just changed dramatically. And when we sort of came out with desktop publishing, all of the publishing cost infrastructure changed dramatically. So anybody could start a magazine. And so after the Mac came out with LaserWriter, magazines popped up like cookies.
Yeah.
And the cost was very different. If you look at broadcast television, it's the same thing. They had tremendous infrastructure, antennas, broadcast stations, all of that stuff. But now that's all of that competitive advantage is gone. If you look at the movie industry, they had theater chains and distribution networks to get movies to theaters.
Mm-hmm.
But now television and on-demand was destroying that model. The music industry needed CDs and record pressing plants, and they had control over distribution. Well, now distribution is frictionless.
Yeah.
So every single media industry that deals with information, whether it's music or film or paper or print or books, publishers and books, self-publishing became very cheap. All of those things changed dramatically. Now, the newspapers would have told you, well, it's our editorial content and our ability to select the good news over the bad news. But what they didn't appreciate was they weren't the only ones with that talent. And so all of these industries are changing. Now, if you switch to education.
Yeah, which I wanted because – yeah, how do you – so do you translate that same series? Because I think education is saying, no, we're not like newspapers because we can – because what we have to offer is exclusive in some way. Does it translate directly? I mean, because I guess the question is, will universities be held harmless from innovative disruption?
No, is the answer.
Yeah.
Is the short answer. Universities are places, okay, currently. They've followed the same thing since the 13th century. They think classrooms are vital, okay? They think that their knowledge base doesn't translate into the world of frictionless information. But that's just wrong. It's just wrong. You don't need a library to get any fact in the world. You can go on the internet and find out the temperature in Zimbabwe in a matter of seconds. Okay, you don't need – every piece of factual information is available.
But you know what you hear in response to that? We were talking about this yesterday in the program, and one person at this University of Wisconsin-Madison had said that higher education is more than just dispensing information. And he said that it's not just about finding a fact or finding a piece of information. It's about applying that learning, applied learning, guiding students through the process, one-on-one, offering them projects to work through it, that which is something that, that he's suggesting you can't do with technology. How do you respond to that?
I believe that you really do have to learn how to think, how to put together pieces of information. Now, the question is a university the only place you can get that, or is it the only communication mechanism that can provide that? And I think the way children are being raised today, most kids know more about technology than their parents.
Yeah.
And their parents are wedded to the way they were taught, and they're hanging on to the way they were taught, and they think that in some sense is the only way to get taught.
Yeah.
And there, in some sense, there's this barrier, there's this divide between what kids are
yep.
and what parents think they should be.
Right, right.
And what school people think they should be.
Yeah.
So think about the capital infrastructure of the University of Utah. There's a lot of classrooms. Okay, there's a lot of heating and lighting and infrastructure to bring people together, and you have to bring people together. But the world is changing in a way that, you know, Facebook is a way people come together. It's not the same. There's one anecdote I can tell. When we were at Xerox, we were chartered with building a printing protocol for all the printers that Xerox produced, which was a lot. There were five of us who were on the design team, and the design took about a year and a half to 2 years, and it was called Interpress at that time. We had, I think, exactly four face-to-face meetings. All the rest of the design was done all over the country via email. And in some sense, the email solution was better because you just couldn't rant and rave. You had to put down your thoughts in a cohesive manner
yeah.
and argue your cases. And it worked amazingly well. And it was sort of a first glimpse that good collaboration isn't necessary. It's not necessary to be face-to-face as much. It's great
right.
in certain circumstances. Now, universities also have laboratories. And there's a whole section of education that isn't going to be impinged by the internet, I think. And it's laboratory work. It's training doctors.
It's this one-on-one that we're.
It's this yeah. well, and it's hands-on.
Hands-on. Yeah.
yeah. But there's a whole section of education that could be vastly less expensive than it is today. Just like newspapers, information you can get on the internet is vastly less expensive than it was in the old days of physical publishing. So all of this world is changing, and to say I'm protected is crazy. You can't say I'm protected.
So what do you think Clay Christensen, the Harvard business professor who's been looking into disruptive innovation, he said, I think it was just yesterday where he said this, he predicted half of all universities will be bankrupt within a matter of 15 years. I'm not sure if you've analyzed the data, but do you think he's on track?
Yes, because like the newspapers, a lot of universities are in denial. They're just in denial and they're saying, gee, you know, I've got tenure.
right. right. You know,
and I don't need to change.
Yeah.
I don't need to change because I'm really comfortable in my skin and I'm really comfortable teaching students the way I taught them in the past, and I don't need to change. I heard a great presentation from the founder of Coursera. Coursera has this free higher education classes authored by university professors from all over the world, and a very good friend of mine, Bob Sedgwick, is head of computer science at Princeton. And he was also at Park.
You were all at Park.
We were all at Park. But he teaches a high mathematics course on algorithms, okay? Very esoteric course. And
yeah.
he built a course. He took a year out and built a course for Coursera. He's had 100,000 students take that course. And he said, I couldn't teach that many students in 30 years. And this has happened over the last year. And I said, well, Bob, why did you do that? Why is this a free course? How do you what are you getting at? And he said, well, there's a textbook that goes along with it, and the students who take the course have a tendency to buy the textbook. And I make some revenue out of that. So the business model for him is, you know, how do I, as a person with intellectual content, make my way in the world?
Yeah.
And, you know, those people are going to come out of the woodwork.
Yeah. So what does a university look like in the future?
Well,
is there still going to be a place, right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there has to, the medical center has to be the medical center.
Of course. But
you know what I would like to see, and this is these are conflicting demands in society right now. Right now, higher education is too expensive. I mean, the University of Utah is very, very competitive. It has a very low tuition rate for the incredible service that it provides. But you look at Stanford, and it's like $40,000 a year,
yeah,
or Princeton, or Harvard, or Yale. Now, what if you could build an infrastructure using technology where you could teach 10 times as many students at the same cost that you have today? In other words, what if you could provide online degrees at half the cost the tuition is? You would, first of all, educate the population of Utah, which I think would be fantastic, because the higher the education, the smarter the populace, the better the government, everything improves.
Yeah.
So I would hope that the educational level of the entire society could be helped by changing the way we teach.
And do you think that that way we teach, even if we change the way, that what we teach, those basics that were important to you, the humanities, liberal education, can still be a part of the equation?
Oh, absolutely. They have to be.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have an educated populace if all you know is how to integrate and differentiate and do mathematical stuff.
So, because I think a lot of people think that's what's going to have to be ditched. You know, that's going to be jettisoned if we go the way of technology. You're saying that doesn't have to be the way at all.
Oh, it's really interesting. The Coursera guys have the dilemma. They say, well, if you teach a course in writing, then the instructor has to grade all the papers, all the output of the students, and it doesn't scale.
Right.
So we have to keep the university the way it is. Coursera found something fascinating, and this is a factoid that I think is absolutely critical. Rather than having the professor grade the papers, they have the peers of the people taking the course grade papers. And they did the analysis, and they found out that the curve of grades was almost identical to what the professor did.
Wow.
So if you statistically, you know, take the shape of the peer analysis, that you get the same thing of the professor. So that does scale.
So is part of this about sharing power?
Yes. It is about sharing power. It's about inventing solutions that don't make the fundamental assumptions that universities make today.
Which are, there's one authority figure
that's
who
right.
disseminates from upon
that's
the
right.
mountain. Yeah.
That's right. That's got to go.
Dr. John Warnock is with us, co-founder of the software company Adobe Systems in Salt Lake City, to give the keynote address at the 16th Annual Siciliano Forum, which happens today at 12:30 at the Marriott Library in the University of Utah campus. You can go to our website for the details, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. John Warnock. He's the co-founder of the software company Adobe Systems. He is helping us continue our series of conversations this week in partnership with the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We're talking about the future of higher education. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call. Stephen is with us. He's been waiting in Provo. Stephen, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
That's fine. Very interesting discussion. And it may have moved on a little bit from my original comment, but you had mentioned that young people know much more about technology than their parents. What has struck me as a science professor is how little students actually know about technology. They can play with their phones, they can, you know, create videos and so forth, but they don't really understand the principles that allow them to create anything new. Mm. It's more at the level of playing games, and you know, they know virtually nothing about coding, for example. They know little electronics. They, you know, all these things that are really important for making advances, they just aren't getting.
I completely...
Didn't you mention, Dr. Warnock, that only 2% are going into computer sciences?
I may have mentioned that at some other time, but it really, you know, these devices that everybody has, and everybody can sort of search the web and do that kind of thing. You're completely right. They don't understand the enormous amount of intellectual effort that goes into building these things. In the realm of software, software has changed dramatically over the last 10 years in terms of the size and scope of programs and the complexity of the systems. We do need fundamental science. We do need fundamental mathematics. We do need fundamental liberal arts. Mm. In other words, listening to music is great. Playing music is an entirely different different proposition.
Right.
Using computers is one thing. Building computers is an entirely different proposition. I think the question for the future is, how do you deliver that education? How can, you know, many, many, many more people learn how to program and learn about the systems that are underlying what we take for granted on an everyday basis?
Stephen, well, you got cut off there at the last, but thanks very much for joining us. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. So I guess the question also comes up, what's the best environment for innovation? You've talked about, for example, the tension between the efficiency in business part of an organization and the innovation part. I guess the key is bringing those both together.
Well, it's actually the only way to work is to keep them separate.
Yeah, is that right?
Because business units, once you have a set, and this is certainly true of Adobe, once you have a set of products that are good and well received by the public, then there is a tendency to optimize those and optimize them so that they get produced very efficiently and so they give the biggest return on
right.
the investment.
Right.
Research and new products is a different activity because it has no efficiency constraints.
Mm.
It doesn't want to have any efficiency constraints. It wants to have freedom.
Yeah.
And it has to have an organization that permits failure and tolerates freedom. And a lot of very tightly run businesses don't do that very well. I mean, when I was CEO of Adobe, I constantly was on how do you preserve innovation in a business environment? And it's a very hard problem because there are two conflicting forces that are effect, and successful forces have a tendency to kill off speculative forces.
So do you – what does that mean, I guess, for those you're asking to create, you – and this was something we were talking a little bit off the air. I'm wondering if this applies, you know, get out of their way in some
levels. Yes.
Bubbles.
The answer is get out of their way. And the answer is you have to have an organization where they can get out of the way. Classic example, we had an enormously successful first product. It was called PostScript. And
right.
we had way more demand than we could supply. And so – I likened it to a black hole. If a resource got close to PostScript, it got sucked in, and all of its energy and cycles and everything were used to feed that business. And we made a conscious decision to take the best engineers and put them in an advanced technology group where they weren't allowed to work on PostScript. Hmm. They had to think. Otherwise, we would have been a one-product company. that would have died an early death like so many startup companies do.
So this, in some ways, this is a question actually that has come up, you know, how it is when you've got all of these companies who they get big and then they go bust. How do you keep a competitive edge? This is one of the ways.
Yeah, I think it's the only way we have discovered that you – now there parts of the research can feed into products.
Sure.
I mean, Photoshop changes all the time. Illustrator changes all the time. And there's that sort of applied research that gets done. And it even though has to be kept separate from the main business machine, because the main business machine wants to be efficient.
Right. It's interesting when you talk about the pace of technology. There's a story you've told about the men who came to see you who demoed Photoshop. This was back in 1989.
Yes.
And you ended up buying Photoshop, but they did it on a machine, a 512K Macintosh.
Yes.
Black and white.
Yes.
And you say at the time the biggest hard drive you could buy was 20 megabytes.
That's correct.
And if you think about just the scale of memory now, it's unbelievable.
And, you know, that I had been exposed actually at Utah to what it took to deal with an image.
Yeah.
And the guys who actually brought it to me worked at Lucasfilm. And they had to deal with images, and actually there's a whole university connection there too. But they brought me this little sort of toy program, and I said, well, you know, we'll probably sell a couple of hundred of these a year, but the world is going to change. And this piece of technology is going to become fundamental because eventually film's going to go away and cameras are going to get better. And it's actually betting on the future. You don't know how the future is going to go,
yeah.
But you know that technology is following Moore's law, and if it follows Moore's law, then you are going to have resources that you don't have. So anybody in their right mind wouldn't have gotten Photoshop unless they had this act of faith where they could say, look, the world's going to change and this is going to be relevant.
Oh, so that's what you – because I heard you say once that don't let your vision be impaired by the fact that your computer isn't fast enough.
That's right. Never be, because the computing environment at Utah when we were all students and doing this is the machine filled the room.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
It filled the room. The super large hard drive that we had was called a Fastran Drum. It held a staggering 5 megabytes and weighed 5,000 pounds. The power of the computer we used is the same as the power of the computer that's in a greeting card that when you open it sings you a message.
Right.
It's a little itty-bitty thing. So the scale of computers is hundreds of thousands of times bigger, faster. And now memory is millions of times bigger than we had in the past. And so – you know, technology has taken us to a place that none of us ever dreamed.
So you have this kind of essential faith that technology moves forward.
Yes.
Is there a downside, though? What do you worry about in terms
of – Not that.
That's,
to me, the land of opportunity.
But you don't worry about – because you hear this a lot, that in an era when there are so many distractions that people are distracted – that they don't interface in the same kinds of way, that we don't have the same kinds of conversations, that the quality of just, you know, human intercourse is different.
Well, the major premise in the ARPA days of all of these research centers that were located around the country, the major presence and assumption was that computers were not going to take over the world like science fiction, but they were going to essentially amplify man's intelligence. Okay, and that's the way they've turned out.
Yeah.
And if you don't want your intelligence amplified, then don't care about technology. If you do want your mind amplified, then embrace it.
So you're saying relax.
Relax. The world is going to change. If you're tied to the way you do things now, get over it.
Do you have any – let me ask you this finally. Do you have any sense at all where technology is headed? I mean, as it continues to evolve, do you have any sense where it – do you think about that much?
Well, I think about, a lot about how it changes business models and how it changes the way we live and, you know, in what form this intelligence takes over time. I mean, the demonstrations of cars driving themselves and things like that are sort of mind-blowing. The fact that you can sort of get any movie in the world anytime you want it is sort of mind-blowing. It's I believe, going to get better. It's going to be more startling. There was this experiment that IBM – that just blows me away – that IBM did in research – its research labs. It put the equivalent of, you know, what was it, 250,000 books on something smaller than the head of a pin using DNA as the encoding scheme.
Wow.
And it's very slow access, but DNA lasts for thousands of years. Anyway, it's all fun.
Dr. John Warnock, the co-founder of the software company Adobe Systems, along with Charles Geschke. He's presenting the keynote address of the 16th Annual Siciliano Forum, and it is coming up at 12:30 at the Marriott Library at the University of Utah campus. You can go to our website, radiowest.org for the details. Dr. Warnock, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Lane Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.